It is a pleasure to be here today, but the heat is more like the Battle of Gettysburg than the Battle of Antietam. Also, I must explain that I've cut out most of the jokes in this sermon because I want to try to make it a little shorter for us all. I'd like to talk to you this morning about how we all have much to learn from UU history, especially during and after the Civil War period, and how that may be of real use to us today. You see, 22 years ago, the Worship Arts Committee had a hard time coming up with anyone to give the sermon on Memorial Day weekend. The all-church retreat was to be held that weekend, and all the usual suspects were not available to speak. I was chair of the committee, so I volunteered. There was also a personal, unstated reason why I wanted to speak. My father had died the summer before, and he was a man who had gone to great pains to have his grandfather's Civil War letters published by the Lehigh Valley Historical Society. I wanted to quietly pay homage to my dad, using those letters as source material which related to the origin of Memorial Day. Here is that publication, and here is a picture of my great-grandfather. As Brian had said, he is William Jonathan Reichard, and although he looks older in that picture, he was only 20 years old. Well, while researching how to present some of the letters, it was just amazing how many times one stumbled on Unitarians or Universalists who were prime movers in the action of those days. Just as Pogo Possum said in his 1971 Earth Day comic strip, "We have met the enemy and he is us," it seemed that we have read history and it is us, or maybe it is UU's. Today I'm not reading any of these letters. Time does not allow. However, if you want to read original historical sources, just a word to the wise, you are not reading today's New York Times editorial page. Words may be used with wildly different connotations than we have today. For instance, the word spinster today is usually used as a negative thing, suggesting the woman is old, maybe bitter, single, and probably of little use to society. In the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, this was a term of respect. A spinster knew a socially useful skill. In the time when we all made much of our own cloth and yarn, one could call a woman a spinster as a title of respect, just as we still call American lawyers Esquire. Likewise, social conventions and etiquette may be very different from today. Consider that many of the combatants who survived the Civil War copied their letters into copybooks after the war. A show about the Civil War sexual practices on the History Channel suggested they were doing this to edit their original correspondence, purge it of sexual or gory references. Note to self. I should visit the Lehigh Valley Historical Society and check to see if any of William Jonathan's original letters are there. But it's not necessary to be so cynical. A letter in the 19th century was considered a gift to the recipient. The veteran would have had to borrow back all the letters written during the campaign, then return them to the original recipients. How do I know this? When I was about 10 years old, after my grandmother had already passed, my mother received a letter from her second cousin, the daughter of Grandma's favorite cousin. That favorite cousin had just died, and in going through her keepsakes, her daughter found a letter written in 1917 in which my grandmother just opened her heart to her cousin about the recent death of her mother, my great-grandmother. My mother explained, "This is the way they used to do things in the 19th century, Elaine. If a letter was sent and kept by the recipient, after the death of that person, the letter was sent back to the sender or to the sender's heirs as a matter of courtesy." In some ways, it feels odd for me to be talking about a war. The feeling of our first hymn today is much closer to my personal take on war and peace. It is also closer to much of the history of our movement. Neil Shister wrote an article in the 2003 UU World magazine discussing the UU approach to war and peace. Quote, Unitarian Universalism is not often identified as a martial tradition, he wrote. Ours is neither a peace church nor a militant church. However, there is a strong pacifist strain of thought in the Unitarian and Universalist traditions. But Unitarians and Universalists overwhelmingly supported the Union cause during the Civil War. This included the Universalist newspaper owner Horace Greeley, who pulled strings at the Republican convention to actually have Abraham Lincoln nominated as the presidential candidate. Julia Ward Howe is the Unitarian who wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic, the North's Marching Song. Also, there is the Boston Unitarian Colonel Robert Gould Shaw, whose story has been so well told in the movie Glory, starring Matthew Broderick and many of the finest African-American actors of our time, such as Morgan Freeman, Denzel Washington, among others. We should mention the Universalist Clara Barton, Brian just told us about in the story for all ages, whose work nursing the men of both sides on the battlefields was a direct patriotic duty by her own admission. Then it really struck me. This time period is not just dead history. It is not just for people who may be descendants of the actual Civil War fighting forces. All the above-mentioned people and many, many unnamed others were really trying to live out ethical principles, perhaps even principles similar to what we now call the UU Seven Principles, as they relate to the great moral wound of that day, slavery. The first two principles are particularly pertinent, namely, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. These were so strongly felt to be violated by the fact of slavery that abolitionists in the North were willing to put their own lives on the line to end slavery. If you are sitting here, if you subscribe to these principles, you have things to directly learn from these earlier UUs. It does not matter if your own ancestors were not even living in the U.S. during the Civil War. It does not matter if they fought on the northern or southern side during the war. It does not even matter if your ancestors were free or slave, indentured servant, kulak, serf, sharecropper, tenant farmer, peasant, landed gentry, lord, or townsperson, because you now hold these ideas today. The earlier advocates of Unitarian Universalism can speak to you. Lincoln's background was more anti-slavery than many people realize. May I suggest a very readable biography of him by Professor David Herbert Donald. That's Professor David Herbert Donald of Harvard University. It's called simply Lincoln. It was written in 1995, which shows the man with a more full background than how we are used to knowing him. This is the book. It's available in many public libraries. It's available online at Amazon. The church he attended as a child was strongly abolitionist. As Dr. Donald put it, quote, Abraham shared his parents' views. He was naturally anti-slavery, he remarked in 1864, adding, I cannot remember when I did not so think and feel, end quote. We hear so much of Lincoln's expert political skills, as if to say all his actions were based on political necessity, not based on ethics. Yes, Lincoln was a political person. He knew that making slavery illegal under United States law would stop the slow drift of British and French settlement towards the Confederates. These two foreign powers were hit hard economically with the cotton drought created by the continuing Civil War. But these two countries were also strongly engaged in halting slavery, and the slave trade in their own domains, and would not lift a hand to harm a country that was attempting to do the same. They were probably hating slavery, too. So, by emancipating the slaves, Abraham Lincoln was making an astute political action. But it went so much deeper with the man than politics. As Lincoln stated at the end of his second inaugural address on March 4, 1865, just 1 month and 10 days before he was shot, with malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle and for his widow and his orphans, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. That phrase, with malice towards none, is my absolute favorite Lincoln quotation. Even Robert E. Lee had said, "I surrender as much to Lincoln's goodness as I do to Grant's army." In the summer of 1862, Lincoln told his cabinet he greatly desired to emancipate all enslaved persons. The description of this time in Dr. Donald's book is really excellent. His cabinet persuaded him to hold off until there was a clear Union victory. And thus we come to the Battle of Antietam, which happened exactly 150 years ago, this September 17th. William Jonathan Reichard, the young man in the photo I showed you, was a 20-year-old in 1862. He was mustered into the 128th Regiment, Company G of the Pennsylvania Volunteers on August 12, 1862, as a private. Straight from training camp, they marched to Virginia, then on to Frederick, Maryland. Moved on September 16th to just outside the town of Sharpsburg, they were ordered at 6 a.m. on the 17th to enter the battle already begun to support General Hooker's troops in what was to become known as the Bloody Cornfield. Immediately, their commanding officer, who was giving orders to position his company, was shot in the heart, dead. The second in command took over to be badly wounded in his arm and borne off the field. The green troops were thrown into momentary confusion until the third in command rallied them. As a Union captain put it, it was the most deadly fire of the war. This is a quote. "Rifles are shot to pieces in the hands of the soldiers. Canteens and haversacks are riddled with bullets. The dead and wounded go down in scores," unquote. As Major General Hooker put it, quote, "Every stalk of corn in the northern and greater part of the field was cut as closely as could have been done with a knife, and the Confederates slain lay in rows precisely as they had stood in their ranks a few moments before." One of William's tent mates and personal friends, Franklin Ritter, was also killed in those initial moments. William's letters tell his father where they buried him so that his family could come take him home, and then waited for weeks, then months, before receiving their haversacks and tents to be able to send home his personal effects. Captain Robert Gould Shaw of the Massachusetts Infantry was wounded in the arm at Antietam. Later, he would become the colonel in charge of the 54th Massachusetts Infantry, as depicted in the film Glory. This was the bloodiest one-day battle in American Civil War history. 22,720 casualties in 12 hours, dead, wounded, missing, or captured. Into this chaos, Clara Barton drove her wagon full of medical supplies. The surgeons were using corn husks as bandages when she arrived with linen bandages. As night fell, with so many still to treat, she brought them lanterns. Several days later, she collapsed from lack of sleep and the beginning of typhoid fever. She was taken back to Washington in a wagon, delirious, to recover and move on to the next battlefield. Antietam is considered tactically inconclusive, but strategically a Union victory. Lincoln issued the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation on September 22nd to take effect on January 1st, 1863. The UUs of the time quickly learned this was not an easy war to win, let alone survive. Horace Greeley's urging the president to free the slaves, along with many non-UUs, bore fruit, but the death and disease was gruesome. The killing technology was way ahead of the healing technology, and public health measures were nearly non-existent. Over two-thirds of the 622,000 men who died in the Civil War died from disease, not from battle. Julia Ward Howe eventually became an ardent pacifist, she who wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic, as did Greeley. The reality of war was stunning. Clara Barton went on to start the American Red Cross to continue aiding persons in disasters. This description is from the northern perspective. Little understanding was shown of the values of the other side. Each side demonized the other. The North saw the South as greedy slavers. The South saw the North as bossy, unwanted invaders who wanted to destroy all their traditions and social institutions. The United States was, in Lincoln's phrase, quote, a house divided, unquote. Doesn't this seem similar to the increasingly polarized political atmosphere today? Might there be a better way to view and interact with our opponents in the culture wars? Consider the work of another author, social psychologist Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-G-H-T, a discussion of whose 2012 book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, was seen on The Moyers Company on PBS, June 1st, 2012. This is that book. It's readily available at your public library or on Amazon. If you like rather thick nonfiction tomes, it's a really good read. However, it's possible to see that same program on the BillMoyers.com website, not PBS, BillMoyers.com, as a full show entitled How Do Conservatives and Liberals See the World? One of the strongest impasses to our mutual understanding is our tendency to demonize the opposing side and not realize the reasons why that side holds its views. This book is worth another sermon by someone far more skilled than I am. For, as Dr. Haidt concludes in his work, quote, we're all stuck here for a while, so let's try to work it out, unquote. May we know our past, learn from it, so as not to repeat it. After all, we have read history, and it is us.